Ray McGovern, who spent 27 years as a CIA analyst. He now directs the Servant Leadership School, an organization dedicated to helping the marginalized poor, and that after a brief break.
Thank you much. You know, I don't know if you all know, but I do know that the government is going to instigate a new national identification policy, and it's not the standard ID card. It's a little grain of rice with your name carved into it by some Mexican that is inserted under the flesh of your arm. And I think it's such an exciting idea that I'm going to be the first in line to get it. It's so cute sounding.
That I must give to you. It concerns suspicious blessings. Now I'm sure you know what to do. But if it should be some bad
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
The World Can't Wait. Cindy Sheehan and Ray McGovern. Cindy Sheehan and Ray McGovern spoke at an event for The World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime, at the International House, Berkeley, California, in March 2006. In this program, you will hear from Ray McGovern. His 27-year career as CIA analyst spanned administrations from John F. Kennedy to George H.W. Bush. He now is co-director of the Servant Leadership School, an organization dedicated to helping the marginalized poor. In 2003, Ray McGovern co-founded Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a group critical of Bush administration policies. He and his colleagues have appeared on TV and radio, on Democracy Now!, and in documentaries such as Uncovered and in John Pilger's Break the Silence, Truth and Lies in the War on Terror. Here is Ray McGovern.
The Bush War Crimes Commission was a very necessary and moving experience. I learned an awful lot. I learned what the Nuremberg Tribunal, the description that Nuremberg gave to a war of aggression, and I want to read it to you. Quote, "To initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole." The accumulated evil of the whole. Think torture, folks. Think rendition, kidnapping. Think illegal wiretapping. Think of all those things. Iraqi General Abed Hamed Mohush had the misfortune of being treated by Louis Welshofer, Jr., U.S. Chief Warrant Officer. Welshofer stuffed him headfirst into a sleeping bag and then sat on his chest, and not surprisingly, the general died from lack of breath. The military jury issued Welshofer a written reprimand, $6,000 of forfeiture of pay, and confinement to barracks for 60 days. The general was said to know all about the 40,000 Iraqi, quote, insurgents, end quote. So, in the words of Robert Fisk, What a terrific idea to stuff him upside down in a sleeping bag and sit on his chest. Folks, we're talking about torture here. And I'd like to point out that this has nothing or very little to do with the apples on the bottom of the barrel, folks. The rotten apples sit at the very top of that barrel. Well, how do we know that? Well, anyone who's read some of the reportage in the documents knows that on 9/11 itself, after he made his evening presentation to the American people, the president gathered together with Don Rumsfeld and with Richard Clark. We know this from Richard Clark's book. And when the subject of international law came up, the president said, and I'm quoting from what Richard Clark said he said, I don't care what the international lawyers say. We're going to kick some ass, okay? Cindy, I'm reminded of a remote reflection of that. When we were in Camp Casey at Crawford last August, there were counter-demonstrators, and one big sign said, kick their ass and take their gas. Kick their ass and take their gas. As for international law, to its credit, AP did file a FOIA report or request and got possession of many of the affidavits and transcripts of the goings-on in Guantanamo. And it turns out that a British prisoner, Feroz Abbasi, pleaded in vain with the Air Force colonel who was the judge there, saying, I have rights under international law. And the judge, the Air Force colonel, replied, quote, Mr. Abbasi, I do not care about international law. I do not want to hear the words international law. We are not concerned about international law. I don't care what the international lawyers say. We know that right after 9/11, that the gloves were to be taken off. We know this by Kofor Black, the previous head of the CIA Intelligence Community Counterterrorism Section, who proudly declared that, yes, we were told to take the gloves off. Well, indeed, they were told to take the gloves off. Who told them? Well, the president told them. Now, I wasn't in the White House at the time, but I can see exactly how it unfolded. The first victim of U.S. torture happened to be an American citizen. Do you remember his name? John Walker Lind. John Walker Lind, at the age of 16, became a convert to Islam and had the poor judgment to end up in Pakistan and then Afghanistan at precisely the wrong time. You probably remember shortly after 9/11, not many of us flinched at the trophy photos that showed Lind sort of naked, tied to a board. He was kept in an unlit shipping container for days, threatened with death, and several of the U.S. types there posed with him for pictures. Part of his ordeal was captured on videotape. November, December 2001. Does that sound familiar to you? Captured on videotape? How do we know this? Well, there was a very courageous woman named Jesselyn Raddick who worked in the Justice Department and who monitored all this because her job was ethics. Her job was procedure. What happened next was the people who captured him got instructions directly from a fellow named Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Okay? Don't handle Lynn with kid gloves, he said. Take the gloves off. Push the envelope. As far as reading him his rights, if he says something incriminating, then read him his rights. Talk about standing Miranda on its head, huh? If he says something incriminating, read him his rights then. Lind was never given Miranda warnings. He repeatedly asked for a lawyer. Those requests were met with indifference. How do we know this? Again, from Jesselyn Raddick, who was monitoring all this from the Justice Department and saying, this is quite weird. As a matter of fact, you're not going to be able to use any of this evidence if you proceed against Lind. Well, fast forward to July of 2002, and we have a situation where the Defense Department is becoming apoplectic because its new policy of torture is about to be revealed. Why? Because John Walker Lind is having a hearing the next Monday. So on a Friday, Chertoff, Michael Chertoff, now Director of Homeland Security, decided that he would face to the situation with a rather novel approach. Ashcroft had already said that, quote, Walker Lind could receive multiple life sentences, six additional 10-year sentences, plus 30 years, end quote. Sound like Ashcroft? Well, Chertoff was going to let him off easier. He'd let him plead to two technical charges, provided, folks, that John Walker Lind sign a piece of paper disclaiming any evidence that he had been intentionally mistreated. This effectively prevented the early exposure of the administration's policy on torture. Again, Jocelyn Raddick pointed this out to her superiors of the Justice Department. She was given immediately an incredibly bad fitness report, and she had to leave the Justice Department. And just as a measure of this regime's vindictiveness, they have blackballed her from practicing law in the state of Maryland, and they tried to do that in the District of Columbia as well. So here's a woman, courageous woman, I would guess she's 30 years old, a good example to the rest of us, stood up for the rule of law, and that's what happened to her. So here's the president. He's going to take the gloves off. So he calls George Tenet, the head of the CIA, and he says, George, you got some fellows down there that can do the job here. The gloves are off. We need to make sure we get every piece of information out of these folks that we capture. And Tenet says, well, let me go back and see. So he goes back, and I wasn't there at the moment, so this is my reconstruction. He comes back to the president a week later and says, yes, sir, we have about seven ex-Special Forces guys, and they're willing to do the necessary. But, Mr. President, you don't mind signing here. This is called a finding, and we don't really do this kind of thing without a finding. And the president says, I better see my lawyer. Now, that's the genesis, I was going to say, of Alberto Gonzalez's famous memo, but it wasn't Alberto Gonzalez's memo. Whose memo was it? Worse, well, equally bad. Anybody? David Addington, counsel to the vice president. He drafted it, open secret, everyone admits it. Gonzalez signed on the dotted line. Okay, this is the one that called Geneva Protections quaint, obsolete, you know. It was a master. I have it right here. This is a wonderful thing about today. This is exactly the way it looked when it went to the president, okay? What else did it say? It's really quite striking. It says that the Secretary of State has requested that you reconsider this decision, the decision being to exempt Al-Qaeda and Taliban folks from the Geneva protections. Why? What did the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, say about it? He said, well, you know, a determination that the Geneva Accords don't apply, quote, could undermine U.S. military culture, which emphasizes maintaining the highest standards of conduct in combat, and could also introduce an element of uncertainty in the status of adversaries. Wow. When did Colin Powell's memo end up with the president? Well, Colin Powell's memo was dated January 26, 2002, and Gonzalez's, Speedy Gonzalez, got his there on January 25th. So here's Powell knowing which end is up, knowing that this will mean the corruption of the institute that he served rather faithfully, at least in his view, and knowing that the Army, and I feel particularly important about this because I served for 2 years as an Army officer, knowing that what would happen if this were approved, and yet corresponding with the President of the United States, by his lawyer talking with Gonzalez. That's a sore point with me. Why Colin Powell didn't march into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, I won't have any part of this. This is going to destroy the army in which I served, the army that I led. I'll never be able to understand. But he did not do that. And so we had the president go forward with this. The memo is really, you ought to read it a couple times. You see, there's not only the Geneva Conventions, there's U.S. criminal law involved here. 18 U.S. Code 2441, which imposes extreme penalties, including death, on all those who would violate the strictures of the Geneva Conventions. So here's Gonzalez acting like a mafia lawyer saying this. If we adopt this course, Mr. President, we can substantially reduce the threat of domestic criminal prosecution under the War Crimes Act, War Crimes Act of 1996. Here's what he says at the end. It is difficult, Mr. President, to predict the motives of prosecutors and independent counsels who may in the future decide to pursue unwarranted charges against you based on Section 2441. Your determination on this matter would create a reasonable basis in law that Section 2441 does not apply, which would provide a solid defense in any future prosecution. Well, my goodness, you know, telling the president, yeah, there's a U.S. War Crimes Act, but we think that if you do this, you can go ahead anyway, and there's a reasonable basis in law that you can escape subsequent prosecution. An amazing document. At the end, and this is the last thing I'll say about this particular document, the U.S. will continue to be constrained by its commitment to treat detainees humanely and pay attention, please, to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity in a manner consistent with Geneva. Now, to extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity, what did the president do with this document? He got it on the 25th of January. Okay, what did he do? We know what he did. We've got this. His memorandum of February 7, 13 days later. And what does he say? He says, among other things, I hereby reaffirm the order previously issued by the Secretary of Defense, okay, Secretary of Defense, requiring that the detainees be treated humanely and, quote, to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity in a manner consistent with Geneva. Now, to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity is a loophole you could drive a Mack truck through, folks, and that's precisely what Rumsfeld, Sanchez, and the whole bunch of them did, okay? That's what they did. Those were the instructions. And they found this fellow, Major General Jeffrey Miller, who would do their bidding. They sent him down to Guantanamo, and the first thing he says is, you're being much too lenient with the prisoners. You have to treat them like dogs. And once they realize that they're just dogs, then you can start interrogating them. His famous euphemism was prepare conditions for successful interrogation. Okay? That's when all the abuses went into Guantanamo. The abuses that FBI people reported, that CIA people reported, all manner of people knew what was going on. And then Jeffrey Miller was sent to Abu Ghraib to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib. Okay, we know that. Janice Karpinski has testified to that. Okay, so this was no accident. Now, where is General Miller today? He tried to retire. He's taken the fifth, Article 31 in the U.S. Code of Military Justice. And why? Well, because the little guys at the bottom, the fellows that were holding the dogs, okay, they asked him to testify on their behalf because they were only following orders. And he took the fifth. Now, in my day in the U.S. Army, if you were an Army officer and you took the fifth of Article 31, you were beneath contempt. And here's General Miller doing that. Now, how did these things get from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib? Well, I've already told you, but I haven't told you the verb used by one of the prominent investigations that the Department of Defense ran, Jim Schlesinger's investigation. They didn't get there by any person. They migrated, folks. These practices of torture simply migrated. So nobody's really at fault if things migrate, I guess. Yeah, right. So John Yoo and Addington and the rest of them all had had a big hand in this. And when I saw the head of the CIA toddle down to the Senate to see John McCain together with Vice President for Torture Cheney, I really lost it. I mean, you know, there have been torture things before, but never has an administration, in my experience of 43 years, been so open about seeking dispensations or exemptions or whatever they wanted so that the CIA could continue to torture even if McCain's amendment went through. I was forced, really, to do what I did, and with respect to giving back my Intelligence Commendation Award medallion. And the occasion was something dreamed up by Jennifer Harbury, whom some of you know. Her husband was brutally tortured in Guatemala, and she's been an incredible advocate for human rights, Harvard-trained lawyer. She and her sister Diana Ortiz, the Ursuline nun who was herself tortured in Guatemala, decided they needed to do something about this, and so they arranged to get 16 orange jumpsuits of the kind that the prisoners wear in Guatemala and Abu Ghraib. And I got an email from her early the morning before this action was planned, and she said, "Ray, we've saved a jumpsuit for you. Would you like to join us?" And the question answered itself. I went over and found out what it was all about. She wasn't willing to put it in an email or on the phone. And it just seemed to me a very imaginative thing, imaginative on many scores. We knew just exactly what we had to do to be able to roam the halls of the congressional office buildings and of Congress itself without getting arrested. And we knew that because of what Cindy Sheehan was subjected to at the State of the Union address. And what you had to do is be alone. Two is a demonstration, folks. You had to not shout anything. You had to not distribute any literature. And, you know, then the dress code didn't matter. And so in a very artful way, Jennifer arranged to have a major press conference together with Sister Ortiz. And press came. We talked about torture. And then Jennifer said, "No, I have to leave now." And she ran over to the Senate Hart building, went into the ladies' room, changed into her jumpsuit, and we all at 11:15 we all emerged from our respective restrooms in the various building, and started walking through the corridors. And I have to tell you that the response was incredible. About 20% of the people just couldn't look, you know. But the others, there was not one that ridiculed me or said, "Hey, what are you trying to do?" You know, they all just kind of looked somberly and, you know, sort of shook their heads. And there was almost a little reverence. I mean, a fellow who was following me, carrying my backpack, was commented that this was really pretty daunting for these folks to face a person walking up and down the cafeteria at lunchtime, you know, and all the halls with this thing on, see? Someone asked me, did I see anybody I knew? Well, I did, as a matter of fact. Jim McDermott, representative from Washington. Terrific guy. And he saw me there, and he looks at me and says, "You're the CIA guy." And I said, no. Today I'm a ghost detainee. And he said, no, I saw you at the Conyers thing. I said, yeah, that's it. And he and I have since had a long conversation, and he's open for even more education on what's been going on. So something good came out of it from that respect, too. I don't want to take too much more time here, but I would like to just say another word about Craig Murray, the incredibly courageous British ambassador to Uzbekistan. We gave him the Sam Adams Annual Award for Integrity and Intelligence. And this is what he said in receipt of that award. This is Craig Murray. "I would like to say something about the advance of evil and how easily it advances. At genuinely no time did I feel that I was doing anything heroic or exceptional. When I came across cases of people being boiled alive, cases of daughters being raped in front of their fathers, cases of torture of children, And the fact that the U.S. and we in the U.K. were receiving intelligence from those torture sessions, it seemed to me axiomatic that anyone brought up in the United States or the United Kingdom would believe their overriding and only duty was to stop it. That's the good news, folks. He goes on. When I started trying to stop it internally, I actually believed that this must be the work of renegade people at the lowest levels, and that once senior politicians in the UK and the US knew what was happening, they would stop it. I was quickly disillusioned. I discovered that this was part of a policy of the use of torture in the pursuit of the war on terror. It was a terrible moment for me. I discovered that the system and the country I'd served my whole life didn't stand for what I believed it did. And I went to meetings with colleagues of mine, people I had known for 20 years, ordinary, nice people, who were setting down on paper strategies by which what we were doing could be said not to circumvent the UN Convention Against Torture. And I was looking at them thinking, I know you, I know you. We went out drinking together. We played golf together. You are setting up justification for torture. How did this come about? And at that moment, I understood how some civil servant ended up writing out orders for the cattle trucks to go to Auschwitz. And I felt, and they felt, that they were only doing their job. And ladies and gentlemen, that is what we face now. The flight toward fascism. End quote.
And that was CIA analyst Ray McGovern speaking on his 27 years spent as a CIA analyst. Coming up next, Radio Beyond Borders presents a documentary on accents produced by Mie Kim. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard features the upcoming exhibit at the Mark Woolley Gallery called Alien and Sedition in association with Sedition Magazine. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, topics include turmoil in Afghanistan, the Senate immigration bill, and losing Arab hearts and minds. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. This KABU program has also been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories, which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
He's America's most censored journalist. He uncovered how George Bush stole the election in 2000 and again in 2004. Now he's ready to show you the whole armed madhouse, from stolen ballot boxes to the war on terror as profit center. KBOO 90.7 FM and the Portland Alliance brings you Greg Palast on Monday, June 5th at First Unitarian Universalist Church at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. Admission $8 to $15. Program begins at 7 p.m., doors open at 6:30. Hosted by Dave Mazza and includes special guest Air America's Tom Hartman. Don't miss Greg's reading from his new book, Armed Madhouse, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Copies on sale and signed at the program. For more information, call 503-239-4991.